Hello and welcome to edition 417 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On the programme today, we'll be talking to Andy Hamilton, the comedy and satire genius behind hit TV shows such as Not the 9 O'Clock News and Outnumbered. He'll be here to discuss his new podcast, Inside Donald Trump.
Plus, we'll be hearing from sculptor Peter Randall Page. He'll be telling us why London's Sculpture in the City showcase, in which he's taking part, is helping move new art into public spaces, even if said art is a fairly large and heavy block of granite.
And we'll be speaking to Claire Conville, the literary agent and creative who's one of the minds behind this year's Curious Arts Festival. Arts, I said, Rob. She'll be telling us how to spot the next big literary talent, hopefully, at the end of the show.
All that plus Monocle's Bill. Lucy will be here with the news look ahead, and we'll play some great music too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24. It's been a while, Tom.
It's been a busy old week because we had to both hot foot it back to the studio from Berlin, where we were, of course, attending the third annual Monocle Quality of Life Conference just yesterday.
Did you put that in an extra pair of inverted commas, the quality of life?
I'm glad you could sort of feel
that. Heard the... It's quality of life and then some.
Whatever's beyond that.
It's quality of life with some taken away.
With good, exactly.
Depending upon what time your flight was. Exactly. And how large your hangover was, presumably.
I don't know what you're talking about, Rob. Nevertheless, a good time was had. And that rounded off another pretty busy week.
Yeah, I feel concerned. A little bit, and I know I look a little bit, like a piece of driftwood that's been kind of washed up on a shore, possibly in an intriguing shape. The kind of thing where you go, should we take that back, put it in the garden? And someone goes, nah, kick it back in the sea. That's a bit how, it's a bit how I feel
so
like
sad.
I've presented myself. Today.
I hope not. What about, I don't know, maybe sort of some kind of labradoodle might pick it up in its jaws and, run along with it.
That's cute. But it's been the end. This is the end, or maybe it's the beginning of a very long week. I don't know. Who knows? And we've done all sorts of things. We put the escapist to bed. That's like a slightly more attractive piece of driftwood, is hopefully now bobbing about on Mediterranean shores and all over the world, of course.
Like a sort of message in a bottle, ready to be uncorked on the other side
of
the world.
Exactly. Very much so. So that's how that's how it's been going.
There's some nice maritime sort of metaphor. Going.
Yeah, that's how I kind of want. I want a jaunty at sea feel to the show.
Well, why don't we get in a jolly Jack Tar? That salty sea dog himself. I think it's salty seawater. It might be something else we're smelling. It's Bill Luty.
Which way?
Where are we going?
Tell us. This
You're
is
in
next
charge.
Week's
this is your
news
segment.
Today.
Well, next week's news, that we'll start at the beginning of the week, Monday morning, tomorrow, bright and early.
Yep.
It's only the start of Wimbledon.
Yes!
Is it? Yeah, you're a fan of tennis?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Tom?
Absolutely love it.
What's your best stroke?
I like a solid double-handed backstroke.
Backhand?
Backstroke.
Backstroke.
Backhand?
Backhand.
I'm mixing my sporting metaphors.
A dirty backhander in a brown envelope.
But that's why I'm dangerous on the court.
Okay.
Because
no one knows where you're coming from.
What I'm going to do next. Okay. I might be wearing flippers and one of those diver
Frogman mask.
A snorkel.
Yeah.
Might have that wrong foot. Even Andy Murray would take a couple of.
There are quite strict rules about what you are and aren't allowed to wear. There was that person that had like a thin black strip down their shorts and they got banned. I'm not sure.
Oh, so
if
I couldn't dress as a frogman.
Okay.
Yeah, as long as it's white, you're fine at Wimbledon. Aren't you?
White frogman's outfit.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I love Wimbledon. It's the British summer, even though it does often rain a bit.
I quite like tennis, you know, love watching it every now and again. But for me, it's more importantly PIM season.
Yeah.
And, strawberries and cream as well.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, and I'm here, I'm in it for the snacks and the beverages, I think. I'm all for it.
So it's part of the season. Wimbledon is part of the season with Ascot and bits of Goodwood and various, Henley Regatta and all these sorts of things. If you're a Pimm's drinker, Bill, as you've said, maybe they'll send you a case. Which of those the season sporting events do you think is the best for drinking Pimm's heavily at and getting away with it?
I'm famous in the office for my passion for cricket.
Okay.
You beat the Test match.
So Lord,
the
Lord's
first
Test match?
Day of the Lord's Test.
That's 5 days long. Yeah. I mean, even when was that? There was that game at Wimbledon that lasted like 3 days, wasn't there, a few years ago?
I mean, Wimbledon does last the full fortnight.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if you get in and refuse to leave.
But so you're going for longevity.
Yeah, and you're allowed to sit there in the sun and drink non-stop for 8 hours a day, 5 days. That's it.
I mean,
coming up next on Talk Sport, Bill's going to be telling you why he hates. No, that sounds good. Okay, I'll be sitting maybe one away from you, one row away from
fine.
You.
Fine. The crowd at a cricket match isn't quite as good as the crowd
but
at tennis.
I can
is
imagine.
It?
And again, our international listeners, go with us on this. Quite often, you get those guys. They've had one too many. They gather all of the plastic pint glasses.
Yes,
that's drinking, good. And they keep
beer
adding
snake.
Them to a sort of huge beer snake. It can be 10, 15 feet long. I imagine Luty, you tottering around with one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to follow around. I'll have like some sort of klaxon or flag.
Possibly dressed as a nun or a
whatever.
Yeah.
Getting
Yoda.
Sunburnt as hell.
You could dress as a banana. Rob, you could dress as one of the great apes and you could chase Bill around.
Yeah.
And there's sort of narrative there.
Yeah, and sort of peel him.
Yeah.
I'll see you at Lord's.
Okay, what's happening next?
Up next, it's a very special day for some people, not for me. Independence Day on Tuesday, July the 4th.
Yeah.
It's a famous day all around the world. I don't really know what it means.
Will people be celebrating with the same enthusiasm, given the occupant of the Oval Office?
Yeah, I don't know, isn't it? Well, it's rather them. I mean, considering they won independence from the British, would they rather have May? I don't know. Possibly, definitely.
That is a goalless. That's a goalless draw, right
it
there.
Is a, it is a. It is a. It is a goalless draw on a grim Tuesday in Grimsby, isn't it? Is what that is.
Do you think that like Donald Trumpism or Donald Trump being in the office is going to turn American US nationalism into
the office?
Sort of,
is he coming in the office?
Sort of
in office.
In office. Sort of turning it into what we see here in the UK. We see nationalism as kind of an ugly beast, don't we? So do you think that will dampen the spirits
not really.
Of the
I
Americans?
Think, you know, the idea of that sort of flag waving, it doesn't have the jingoistic connotations in the US. It's still about restating national pride. I think in this country, we're very sort of Victorian about it and it all seems rather over the top.
Oafish. Yeah, exactly.
And we don't have songs like Yankee Doodle that we can top potter around.
I mean, listen to
sing.
All the verses of God Save the Queen. It doesn't leave much to the
imagination. Yeah, but it's not as jolly as Yankee Doodle. That's like...
No, terrible. It's terrible.
Most of them are terrible, yeah.
Well, that's good. We should also say it's also Emily Smith's birthday, 4th of July, Independence Day for her. Mutual friend of ours, obviously. Big fan of the show.
Big fan of the show.
Big fan of the show.
Shout out to you.
Coming up next on Steve Wright. Let's just pretend this is all the other shows in the world.
And once again, if I can just give a shout out to our international listeners. Yeah. Who now are wondering, what is this?
Who are these people
who
he's
are these
talking
people?
About?
Well, they
That's
are going to be
Google's for, isn't it?
Sorely disappointed that they won't be able to attend the next event, which starts tomorrow, Monday, and lasts all week.
Mm.
It's only Britain's biggest naturist convention, Nudefest.
Nudefest.
Where's this taking place,
This
Bill?
Is taking place in the West Country.
Down
all of the West Country?
It's in a large area.
Mind you, don't burn your West Country.
It's just near Taunton.
I bet it is.
You're just taunting us with that, aren't you? Can you give us a postcode?
What do you need? Yeah. Thorny Lakes, Langport, Somerton, ooh, near Taunton.
Becomes the last thing you want is to go for a wee near a thorny lake.
The whole thing turns into a large nudist event. There's loads of stuff, including, and I like the sound of this one, nude yoga.
Nude yoga.
Oh,
good.
You're going to see some things you're not going to forget in a hurry.
Fencing.
I don't know.
Any fencing going on? Trampolining?
No fencing, because you probably need protective clothing for that. There's sacred dance, body painting, belly dancing, and photography.
Photography, of course.
And a treasure hunt.
Where would you hide your pieces of eight, Rob?
Just under my fringe.
I don't know. So, I mean, there's something to be said, I think. When the weather's nice, you can get down there. Surely there's an air of relaxation. And, well, you just become very personal. Once you've broken down that barrier, then Thorny Lakes is your oyster. I'll see you there at Nudefest.
Looking forward to that in no way whatsoever. Thank you very much, Bill Luty. We'll be talking about, some other things that are on the actual news agenda after this.
Andy Hamilton is a British comedy writer with some formidable hits to his name. They range from TV family sitcoms such as Outnumbered to biting political satire such as Not the 9 o'clock News. And he's a regular face, of course, on some of the UK's best love panel shows too.
He returns to satire for his latest project, the podcast Inside Donald Trump. It's a three-part fictionalised account of the US president's rise to power. But in this era of fake news, Andy's arguing it might well actually be a piece of investigative journalism. And it's presented by a very real face of the news here in the UK, the former anchorman on The Beeb, Michael Burke. Let's hear a clip.
What you're hearing is the sound of an anonymous leak. It's a tape of a private encounter on the golf course at President Trump's exclusive Mar-a-Lago resort between President Trump and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. What happens next is very revealing.
Mr. President, the Chancellor says thank you for inviting her to watch you play golf and...
It's okay. No need to translate.
You speak German?
I speak perfect German. Terrific German. I love Germany, by the way. I love the Germans. The Germans love me. I respect Germany so much you wouldn't believe it.
Right. It's probably still best if I translate.
There's no need, I just said.
Okay then, Mr. President. Are you going to reply to the Chancellor in German?
I think she said everything that needs to be said. Now, watch me tee off. This baby is going straight down the middle of the fairway.
Oh my God!
Like I said, straight down the middle.
And Andy Hamilton joins us now to discuss inside Donald Trump and more besides. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Andy. Good to have you with us. Now, I've got to start off by saying, highly entertaining programme. But why get started? Because everybody says you cannot satirise the unsatirizable, and that the real Donald Trump, left to his own devices, is as ridiculous as it can possibly get. Why did you beg to differ?
Well, I sort of took that as a bit of a dare, really. I regard it as a documentary full of what Kellyanne Conway would call alternative facts, and delving into his psychology. And I thought the thing that would be really interesting would be to sort of dig really deep into his childhood and into the forces that shaped him. And so, yeah, extreme as Donald Trump's personality is, I think the portrait that we reveal in Inside Donald Trump shows something even more bizarre and surreal. But you're right, it is hard to keep pace sometimes. And since we made it, of course, he's come out with various peachy little bursts of mild insanity. Well, not mild insanity.
I think it's pretty fully fledged, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, I first started thinking about doing it in that period after he got elected, where everybody said, oh, you know, all that stuff during that campaign, that was all just an act. It was all front of tab stuff, you know. And then the first few months, he was pretty out there. And it just felt to me like the sort of the media in general were kind of refusing to admit to themselves just how mad he is. So, you know, I thought, well, he created this Hall of Mirrors, so why not go and have a play in it? So that's what the piece is.
And it starts off, the podcast starts off at a psychiatric hospital.
Yes.
And it kind of goes, and it yes, obviously goes from there and rolls
from
there.
Give too much away.
No, I don't want to give too much away, but that's kind of that's the level on which you're taking it, as in, you know, in these are inferred conversations. We are inside the head of the lunatic, or at least the people that treated him.
Yeah, it's an extension of, I hesitate to use the word reality in any context now, but it's a mixture. It's surreal, but it's based on observed things. And it's all rooted. There's a little section where a friend of Donald Trump's recalls the moment where Donald Trump got excited about and interested in golf. And, you know, although it's comic, there's a wonderful interview with Samuel L. Jackson where Samuel L. Jackson talks about what it's like to play golf with Trump. And so it was kind of rooted in that. And then I thought, well, I wonder what the first moment was when he decided that this was a sport for him. And I think you're right, of course. And there is a danger. Well, there are two dangers, I think. I think from a creative point of view, there is a danger that the audience gets trumped out because he works through relentlessness, you know, and attrition. He does something absurd and ridiculous and stupid. But then while the commentariat are still chewing that over, he just knocks it off the agenda with a new thing, you know, which is his version of the dead cat strategy. Although it's like he uses real dead cats sometimes. But I think the other danger as well is that people stop getting angry about it. You know, a lot of comedy writing about topical events, you know, a lot of satirical writing, the root of it is that you're angry about it. So, and I think it's quite important that we don't stop being angry about him. You know, if he starts just becoming this sideshow, he is unfortunately the most powerful man in the world. And it's an extraordinary moment when the most powerful nation in the world has chosen a man who lives in a fantasy world.
Well, on that point, it's interesting. We reassure ourselves, certainly here at Monocle, that this is actually a bit of a golden age, maybe for long form journalism, serious tabloids, you know, serious newspapers, or I should say the broadsheets, who are actually gaining readers who want to find trusted sources.
Yeah.
So although I started by saying, oh, you know, is it a hard time for satire? Is it one of those moments where, as a satirist and as a comic writer, you begin to understand that your power matters almost more now than in more benign times?
Whether it's power or not doesn't, I wouldn't go as far as saying that, but I think it's important.
It has, I guess it has a potency.
I mean, I think it's important that comedy is a means of pointing out the absurdities and the injustices. That is important. I think what's difficult for satirists is being original. Enjoyable as it is, the stuff on Saturday Night Live is not that original. It doesn't go very far beyond just the absurdity of the individual personalities in the White House, you know, and I think that's the really hard bit.
I really like the name of the podcast, I like Inside Donald Trump, because we have a flavour of investigative journalism, of a man running around with a boom mic, Roger Cook style, Nick Broomfield style, but also, in my head, maybe it's just my sick mind, I have an idea of the latex glove at the airport.
Right.
Was that part of the naming strategy, or is it just my? Is it actually
my
sick mind, Danny?
No, I think our sick minds.
We kind of want to see Donald bent over. And
I think our sick minds possibly
align,
coalesce, slightly.
You put my mind at rest.
Yeah, there is a whiff of the colonoscopy about the title. You're right.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's a surgical comic colonoscopy, but in his brain. That makes sense. If it was possible to do a colonoscopy of someone's brain and send a camera
through the ear,
if you send the camera through the ear, then that's what this would be.
And I wonder, Ellie, I mean, it's interesting because Trump, as you mentioned, the sort of leader of the free world, the most powerful man on the planet, does that mean that your approach and your team's approach to this is different? Because the audience presumably is definitively global. There'll be as many people interested in poking fun, or maybe they wouldn't be, in poking fun at Trump stateside as there are in the UK, for instance. Is that strategy different? I mean, you've pastiched other things before, going back to newsrooms here in the UK, you know, early in your career. Is the writerly approach different, or actually do you have to just stick to your guns?
On this, I just instinctively wrote the things that interested me and made me laugh. And I thought things that I thought were interesting points that needed making. I tend not to, this is going to sound really arrogant, but I tend not to think about the audience too much. No, I'll rephrase that. I tend not to worry about the audience too much. I've always worked on the premise that I have to presume that the audience are roughly like me. You know, there has to be an element of... Now, that's probably a complete self-delusion. That would presuppose that I'm at some sort of mean of normality, which I'm sure is far from the case. If they're honest, most writers... are like that. A lot of comedians are also like that. I think some comedians second guess a lot more, but I've always gone down. And, you know, the worst that can happen is that I'm wrong, in which case the phone stops ringing.
So you'd learn pretty quickly.
It's a fairly basic form of audience testing.
And in terms of that, what about the format as a podcast rather than something that comes out on the radio, for example, on BBC Radio, obviously, with which you've had links to before many times? Does that feel like a medium on the rise as well? Does it feel like the right time to be doing this as a podcast, as something that people are definitely tuning into? They're not going to pass by it. They're not going to tune the dial through Radio 4 and pick up on someone, you know, it being funny and sticking with it. This is kind of appointment to listen, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an active choice, isn't it? That is interesting. I mean, I'm just learning. To be honest with you, a few months ago, you would probably have had to explain to me exactly what a podcast was. I'm digitally the least savvy person in the world. And it's been quite interesting in terms of how you publicise it, you know, where you go.
Yeah.
You really have to find people who like listening to podcasts. You know, I mean, I have a very solid, very dependable Radio 4 audience, you know, but I don't think that many Radio 4 listeners have yet made the cross to go and seek out podcasts, you know. So this is
I wonder if they're listening live or whether they are actually kind of listening again. I guess that's the thing, right? Because all you have to do is you're two clicks away from discovering something, and an avalanche of stuff gets sent into your iTunes account and all the rest of it.
As far as is possible, I mean, obviously I don't always get to choose, But I do like working in different mediums, and I do like hopping around. And it is interesting to discover a medium that it not only is growing, but is still kind of defining itself early on, you know, and evolving. I mean, to a certain extent, TV and radio evolve, and maybe film, maybe less so. But this feels like the early stages. This feels like the beginning of something.
Now, you mentioned there working across mediums. What about your approach? We touched on it sort of briefly earlier about whether you tailor your approach depending on where things are airing. What about across those mediums? I mean, do you still think, oh, you know, nothing better than getting my teeth into, I don't know, a big TV sitcom? Or do you like a team where you're collaborating with people? Do you have a personal preference? Or is it more a question of saying, I've not done X or Y for a few months or years and I'd like to try that again? Or do you just do whatever rolls around?
To be honest, my favourite thing to do is usually the thing that somebody said yes to. I mean, that is usually what decides it. I love writing. That it's a fantastic job. It's a brilliant way. If you can earn a living from it, it is a great way to earn a living. But I do love collaborating on productions. I love going filming. I love assembling a cast and working with a cast. And so I do like being in a team. So I'm really jammy because I get to do both, you know. So I have the kind of me time, if you like, where I'm just at a desk, you know, staring at a page, just coming up with and hearing voices in my head. But then I also get to execute that. And to do that, people have to be very good, you know, to do what you want them to do, both in the crews and in the cast. Particularly when I work with Guy Jenkin, we ask him to do really difficult stuff. Over the last couple of years, we've done various very, very last minute filming things like Ballot Monkeys and Power Monkeys and Election Spy, where you're literally just throwing lines at actors because you've just seen something on the news and it's going out that night, you know. To be able to do that, you have to have people who are really good around you at every level, you know, because they have to be confident enough not to be fazed by that.
Is that something you might have to get more used to, actually, having to do that more reactive stuff? As we said, it's almost, you've managed to nail it, but it's difficult to do satire about Trump because the fact is often weirder than the fiction.
Yeah.
Do you feel that actually that things are changing? Although, you know, podcasts are something that you download each week, each day, however it might be, that actually the news cycle is becoming so quick, bolstered by the speed of social media and all the rest of it, that actually that you're going to have to be writing lines on more actors' hands and just sending them into the lights, you know?
Yeah, well, no, the news cycle has got very fast. I mean, it's often wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
because at the moment, the pressures are on people to get it on air before they know if it's true or not. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that pulse of that cycle has got so fast now. Mind you, we had a situation on both Ballot Monkeys and Power Monkeys where because we were kind of addicted to the news and because we had our other writers kind of scanning Twitter and everything, we were actually onto things a bit too quickly. So a couple of times people say, oh, I saw Ballot Monkeys last night. You go, oh, yeah, did you enjoy it? They said, yeah.
It's my new breaking news service.
And they said, that thing about Paddy Ashton, was that true? And we said, yeah. And of course, you know, that's the danger. When you're sponging up the news all day, you forget that most people kind of scan the news in quite an ephemeral way, you know. So we got a little bit too fast at times.
That's interesting. That's really interesting, actually, that you can be actually providing an accidental news service. Was that thing about Paddy Ashton true? It always is.
There are a lot of whatever you heard. Yes. What about some of the? I mean, we'll keep this British for a moment, and some of our international listeners may lose their way slightly. But look at the cast of players. I don't know that we're satirizing now.
Yeah.
People keep saying, oh, it's an unprecedented time for politics and whatever it might be. Is it a challenge to be funny about people who seem to be, I don't know, clinging on to power by their fingernails, or whether the merry-go-round of political appointments circulates too quickly? I mean, if you think back to the 80s, you had these great titanic figures who were there and they could be mocked and derided and everyone got to know all of the facets of their character. Is it harder when people are, frankly, almost less well-known or seem less
relevant?
Or don't
hang around.
Yeah.
It could be. I mean, at the moment, you know, there's a lot of undignified behaviour going on, which is always a very rich comic seam that you can mine. I think in general terms, because of the very fast 24-hour news cycle, and because, you know, an election can get reduced to a bacon sandwich or a, you know, they're so fearful of the gaffe or the, you know, the misstep or the whatever, that most of the politicians now are extremely circumspect. And in fact, Theresa May is almost like the logical destination of that in a way. She's like a study.
Well, they kind of say nothing. So
a
they
study
don't say
in saying nothing,
thing,
yeah. Which at one level makes it harder, because when I started writing in the mid-70s, there was a whole canvas of really colourful characters. I mean, there were people like, you're probably too young, but there was a man called George Brown who was in the Labour government. He was he was pissed all the time.
He was the man who asked who got the Archbishop of Lima confused with some floozy at a party, right?
And wound
her around the dance floor only to realise that he was the Archbishop of Lima.
Yeah, he was the one who's always tired and emotional.
That's right.
Or
emotional.
The other one, of course, was the side effects of medication. But he was a very prominent, you know, in fact, he stood for the leadership of the Labour Party against Harold Wilson. So, you know, there were people like him, and there was, you know, there were, hateful as he was, there were the Enoch Powells and the Tony Benns. And now, I mean, there's very few people with big personalities. Mm. And even the ones who have big personalities, like Boris, it feels like a bit of a confection. You know, it feels like a bit of a turn, if you ignore Farage, then, which is good, that's what you should do, because it annoys him. You know, you got Farage.
There's not that same palette, is there?
No, that's right. Yeah. The palette isn't there. It's
And even Nicky Soames has gone on a drastic diet.
Yes.
Which is a terrible show.
Yes, right? He's kept
everything.
The voice.
He's kept the voice.
But at the level of the personalities, it's got less rich. But politics has kind of, for the last 2 or 3 years, has exploded. You know, we had quite a conformist, stable period, and that does seem to, in many ways, it does feel like a rerun of the 70s, you know.
Well, and just briefly, I mean, what about, we got, you know, Brexit and this basically massive pan-European shit show that's going to be involved.
Yeah.
Do you sort of look at that and think, oh, that's something I'll be able to get my teeth into in the next 2 years? Or do you face it with dread and fear and apprehension like the rest of us?
Yeah. Actually, Brexit, I think, will not be a great comedy gift.
Is that because there are some things that you just can't laugh about?
Actually, because half your audience also, not everywhere, it is a kind of, it's a funny thing with your audience, you don't know who your audience are.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I mean, I've done stage shows, you know, I've been touring and the audience is split on Brexit. But interestingly, on both sides, there is clearly a feeling that it's going to be a long and rather tedious slog. And I think that's the problem, is that the story is soon going to be turning on what feel like rather arcane distinctions between the Norway formula or the Switzerland formula. Yeah. Or the, you know, there's a limit to the number of jokes you can get out of should we be in the customs union or not. I mean, everyone's going to get very angry because, you know, you've got the Brexiteers who actually want to be betrayed. I mean, that's the secret, I think, to the sort of personality of the hard Brexiteers, is they are sitting, they're like sort of sadomasochists. They want to be betrayed. Farage wants to have to come back from the wilderness like de Gaulle and rescue the country, you know, because that's the narrative in their head. Mostly they are people whose whole life has been somebody else's fault, you know, so they want that outcome. But I mean, but the actual story itself is going to get very sort of serpentine and elaborate, I think.
Well, luckily we have people like Andy Hamilton to take us by the hand and guide us through it.
No, I don't understand. I don't understand the fine distinctions between, you know, I don't know what the Norway formula is. I don't think.
I like that. I think that's a good, slightly odd way to end our discussion. Andy Hamilton, thank you so much. Inside Donald Trump, are all the episodes out now?
Yeah.
Ready to go?
Yeah, I think obviously it's available on iTunes, or you can go on. Yeah, if you Google SoundCloud Inside Donald Trump, yeah, it's 3 episodes. One deals with his childhood, one deals with his career and life as a man before the presidency. And the last one deals with the presidency and what might be to come. Yeah.
Perfect. Andy Hamilton, congratulations on it. Oh, yeah.
Actually, sorry, while I've got a microphone in front of me.
Yes.
Can I do one more plug? I've got a paperback version of my novel out there as well now. It's called The Star Witness, and that's published by Unbound. So.
It's an unbound fest.
It is an unbound
John
fest.
John Mitchinson, his shadow looms large
he's
over Midori House.
He's a good friend
Midori
of ours
House.
Here, yeah.
It is an unbound fest, yeah.
Nice one, Mitch.
I'm just racking my brains now, thinking.
What else have we got?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about his podcast?
I've got some watches in my suitcase. They're really nice. They're, yeah.
Andy Hamilton, get the hell out of here.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
I'm embarrassed now.
Rob, I think possibly time for a musical interlude. How does that sound to you?
Yes, please.
Time for new music. This is from Philadelphia, Artie Popper's Palm. This is Two Toes.
And that was Palm with Two Toes. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, and we'll be hearing about sculpture just after this. Sculpture in the City is London's festival putting art into public places for all to enjoy. Among the 16 artworks on show this year are pieces from Ryan Gander, Martin Creed and more.
Another of the artists taking part is Peter Randall Page. His sculptures are celebrated for working the beauty and complex geometry of nature into a brand new creation. His contribution to Sculpture in the City, Envelope of Pulsation, for Leo, is carved from a rare block of granite taken from the Blakenstone Quarry in Dartmoor here in the UK. A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Peter to learn more.
It's a sculpture that I suppose does fit into a long-standing interest of mine in sort of pattern and form and theme and variation, the way in which in the natural world and in the world of human culture, we do use this business of theme and variation, that pattern seems to be absolutely everywhere in the natural world. Obviously, theme and variation we usually associate with music. But I think when you start thinking about the tension in everything, whether it's organic or inorganic, or whether it's things that we produce as artwork and music and so on, they all have this kind of tension between underlying patterns, and at the same time, no two elements are exactly the same. And that it's that tension, in a way, it's that tension that drives the whole evolutionary process. If it was only pattern repeating itself, nothing would develop and evolve. It requires those random variations for things to change and move forward. And of course, in music and in art, it is the vitality of life-giving force, if you like.
It is. It's a curious thing, isn't it? Because, I mean, I can see it in your work. Your work, maybe on first glance, maybe to a sort of a layman, perhaps even someone just passing it in the street, as they might do with this newest one, that, you know, you incorporate what look like quite sort of mathematical, almost geometric shapes. They're all drawn from nature, aren't they? And nature does have that. It has that strange preciseness to it, doesn't it? Like if you look at a snowflake, the patterns inside that are just, they look like they've been sort of machine drilled or machine sort of designed, don't they?
Absolutely. No, I mean, that is really what fascinates me. And you mentioned mathematics and geometry. One can't go very far in terms of studying natural phenomena without running into mathematical patterns. And, you know, in a sense, the laws of physics, it does underpin everything. And these things are best understood in terms of maths and geometry. But of course, the wonderful thing is in the real world, you never find a perfect circle or a perfect equilateral triangle or a perfect hexagon. They're always slight variations, but you can always kind of see the underlying, if you like, the underlying theory on which these infinite variations are based.
When we zoom in on these patterns of nature in the microscopic sense, as I was saying, we can see the intricate and the extremely precise nature of them. But then when we say, you know, as I was saying, if you look at a tiny snowflake, you can see how it's made. But if you're looking at snow in a field, you think, oh, there's a big expansive blob of white. You don't see any of that preciseness. Do you think that if you were to zoom out of, this is a very strange question, but do you think it's because we're sort of too close to it? If you were to zoom out and look at the Earth microscopically, you'd begin seeing these very precise patterns to what we think are random.
Yeah, I mean, you say it's an odd question. Actually, it's not an odd question to me at all. I think it's an extremely pertinent question. And I think, you know, if you do that thing of zooming in and zooming out, I mean, you see almost go through these sort of levels of close to geometric precision. I mean, the Earth and the planets and so on, not perfectly spherical, but damn near spherical. You go in a bit further, you start looking at coastlines. These seem quite chaotic and the result of many, many geological and, you know, physical climatic changes. And you get this very chaotic seeming sort of coastline. You zoom in a bit further and you start looking at plants and leaves and cellular structures and crystalline structures, molecular structures, atomic structures. It seems we go through these sort of levels of something that appears quite chaotic, and then you go in a bit closer or you go out a bit further, and suddenly you realise this extraordinary overarching geometrical precision which everything kind of matches up to. I mean, the interesting thing for me, it's a bit like, you know, the ideas that Plato had in his dialogues, that somehow there is an ideal of everything somewhere out there in the ether. Now, of course, we don't believe that, but there's a way in which absolute precise geometry and mathematics only exists in our imagination, and we understand it by extrapolating from slightly varied examples on the fundamental form. Do you know what I mean?
I'd like to talk about your visit to the island of Lolwy in Lake Victoria to explore prehistoric rock gongs in the ancient rock art. Please do elaborate on what that is, because that sounds fascinating.
Well, it was fascinating. I mean, I've been extremely lucky to have some extraordinary experiences and go to extraordinary places on the back of my profession as a sculptor. And this is certainly a real prime example of that. It came about because a friend of mine who runs a foundry, the biggest art foundry in Britain now, Pangolin Foundry in Gloucestershire, he grew up in Uganda and he'd heard about this island in the middle of Lake Victoria where it had actually been evacuated because of sleeping sickness and so on and kept empty for a very long time from the early 20th century to the mid 20th century. But there were a couple of expeditions there and they discovered rock art and also indentations on these extraordinary rocks piled up a bit like giant versions of Dartmoor Tors near where I live. And when you hit them in these places where the indentations are, they have a wonderful resonant sound, and this sound carries a long distance. And in fact, this is a phenomenon you find in different parts of the world, and they're known as rock gongs. So we went with a group of Ugandan musicians and musicians from the London Sinfonietta, and myself with my combined interest in music and rock and sculpture. And it was a great adventure, and much music was made, and a lot of drawings. I made a lot of drawings and one sculpture that I left on the island made of local material.
We should clarify to listeners, are we talking about rock and music or are we talking about rock music? Please do tell.
We're talking about rock and music, I think, rather than rock music. Yeah. I'm rather more of a Baroque fan myself, and jazz actually. I mean, the music I get most from is sort of Bach and things like Thelonious Monk and Charlie Parker.
Yeah, I won't make any jokes about Baroque either. Sorry about that.
Good.
You make these sometimes quite monolithic pieces, but you do make smaller works as well. I understand that you have some works in the Hignall Gallery in London as part of Mayfair Art Weekend. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, I do make work on lots of different scales. I mean, some, you know, small enough to fit in the palm of your hand, and some, you know, weighing 70 tons and on a really monumental scale. I also do drawings and etchings and work in other materials other than stone, like metal and wax and various things. I mean, just going back very briefly to the piece that's in the Art in the City called The Envelope of Pulsation for Leo, just a little background on that. The Envelope of Pulsation is a kind of tantric term for form. So they're considering that form, the forms we see in the world, are envelopes of a kind of pulsating energy, and I love that idea. The for Leo bit of it is the quarry where the stone came from, which is very local to me on the edge of Dartmoor, belonged to a slightly eccentric Dutch merchant seaman called Leo, who sadly died a few years ago. But when he died, his wife gave me that piece of stone. And it's an unusual piece of stone. Mostly when you get a quarried block of stone, it has quarry marks on it. So it'll have drill holes or saw marks. This stone was that overall shape. Obviously, I've worked into the surface in relief, but the stone itself was that shape, which means that when the molten magma shrank and cooled deep in the ground, the shrinking created these cracks, and that was the shape of that block. So it's a kind of naturally occurring block, if you like, which appealed to me greatly, and I made it as a tribute partly to my dear friend Leo.
There's a nice sort of synergy there, isn't there? And I mean, obviously you're a creative, and you shape and you sculpt these rocks in a creative form, but also they're being created in any number of shapes naturally, as you were describing, from nature itself.
Absolutely. I mean, the stuff that I'm dealing with, when I'm dealing with particularly igneous rock, is the result of, you know, innumerable chance events stretching back to the formation of the Earth itself. So that's quite a kind of, it does give one a little bit of a perspective to work with material like that, and gives you a sense of just how small and short-lived we are.
It's envelope of pulsation for Leo. It's been a long time coming, right?
That's right. It has.
A few million years.
A few million years, and then a bit of time with me chipping away at it as well.
Sculptor Peter Randall Page talking to Monocle's Tom Hall there, and you can see Peter's work and many others within London's Square Mile as part of Sculpture in the City right now.
We love a chat about books with authorly talent here on The Weekly, but what about the talent behind authorly talent? A literary agent with an eye for the next big hit is one of the most essential parts of the publishing process, so we're very happy to be joined by one such now. Claire Conville's one of the minds behind the Conville & Walsh agency, and has helped steer the careers of writers such as Booker winner DBC Pierre and crime novelist SJ Watson in the past.
Now she's helping the public get closer to the authors they love as co-founder of the Curious Arts Festival. Returning for its fourth year, taking place in Hampshire in the UK from the 21st to 23rd of July, it gathers not only famous novelists but historians, poet laureates, musicians and more. And Claire is, of course, on hand to tell us. Claire, welcome to the programme. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you for
having me. Congratulations on four curious years as well, right?
Yeah, it's hard work, and it can be quite attritional. And in my family, we have something called the Joe Simpson 15 Minutes, which is, I don't know if you know, but when he fell off the mountain and was very badly injured, he broke his time up in 15 minutes.
Right, okay.
Intervals to sort of get through. So there are always a moment at the festival when you think, I don't know how we're going to get through the next 2 months, but I'll break it up in Joe Simpson 15 minutes.
So Joe Simpson 15 minutes, that's time for a large gin tonic.
Yes.
A micro nap. A crafty fag around the back.
A crafty fag, but making lists. Lists are the absolute prerequisite of running any festival. And because I have a day job as a literary agent, I do a lot of the work at night. So I have been known to wake up in the middle of the night, sort of, you know, 2:15, worrying about something, reach for a pen and write stuff on the wall behind me.
So as long as
I don't forget things.
One day they're going to auction that wall, and I'm going to have my hand up right at the front, of the auction house. For that one, I would like to kind of, we're going to divvy up your day job, as you call it, as part of the literary agency and the Curious Arts Festival. But I wonder whether we need to, because presumably these things are kind of happy, very happy bedfellows, despite the fact that you're scrawling on the wall as the third person in that bed. So one feeds into the other. This is a good place to also, I guess, see how much people love your novelists, kind of in the flesh. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think it's, I realise my job is very simple, and my job is to get stories to readers, and in fact stories to people who watch television or films or listen to audio. So in a way, a festival is a natural extension of that. It's not just getting stories to readers, it's getting the authors of those stories to readers too. And it's a hugely enjoyable process. It's very taxing. There are all sorts of variables. And England is unusual in the number of festivals. I mean, it's a real industry. And you have to carve out something that is highly unique, original, fun, an experience. It can't just be tents in the field, as I've said before. It's got to be a real experience from beginning to end. And so sense of detail, organize. It mustn't look too organized, but of course it's got to run like clockwork. It's got to flow free, as it were, but behind it, you know, there was teams of people working on production, working on PR, working in the box office, you know, providing lovely food and drink, you know, feeding the snails for the snail racing, things like that. So it's a massive amount to organise. We have a sort of Google Docs thing, which I can't even open, let alone sort of input. So
sounds like my office experience.
So I just, as I say, make endless lists and it's anything from sort of lavatory paper for the loos to, you know, write a really lovely letter to sort of Dave Eggers and Mandela, his wife, to see if they'll come to the festival to...
And they are this year, aren't
they? And they are coming to the festival this year, which is great, to sort of work out how we're going to get the Royal Philharmonic to come round and play Bond tunes, which they're coming to do, which we're very excited about. So it's a very variable job. And as I say, you have to have an eye for detail. You have to be very well organised, but look as though you're sort of floating around in a sort of, you know, bohemian way.
Is that enough? I wonder too, is there some serendipity? Because I guess some people say, look, organising anything like this, it's a bit like herding cats, and you have the literary sorts, and I don't in any way want to sort of besmirch their collective reputation, but sometimes they're not necessarily the best at being where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be. Is there a bit of good fortune as well? And it means people can enjoy kind of almost seeing the joins a little bit.
Well, it's funny, actually. Actually, people are very, very professional about it. I think there's a big, you know, literary event circuit now. Again, people love connecting to their audience. Most authors love connecting to the audience. And actually, the space in which Power Park is beautiful, beautiful country house. We have 120 acres of gardens and lakes. But actually, the space where the festival operates is quite sort of tight-knit. So even though we'll probably have 5,000 people there this year, you can get to where you need to be quite easily.
You can corral some of the
wanderers. Occasionally you have to sort of drag an author out of a bar, but, you know, it's a festival.
I can't believe it. Surely not.
And this is, because this is the thing, this is how I wanted to kind of jump across the Hellespont between those two things, the day and the weekend job, Claire. Are most authors kind of now media trained? Or do you have to do it for them? Because the solitary occupation suddenly becomes something in a tent, and it suddenly you have to become a raconteur about something that you've kind of has taken years of kind of teeth grinding lunacy in front of a typewriter.
How
does that work?
I think it's a really good point, and I think there are some people who just can't do it. But really, most of the authors.
I'll tell my friend Alex Preston that. I see he's on your list.
When we're looking forward to greeting him, but I mean, most authors are brilliant at it, actually. But I do think it depends on also a very good interlocutor, you know, if somebody's a very experienced interviewer and kind of dig a little deep without being oppressive or intrusive, you can get some very interesting, you know, get very interesting response. And also, I think you can freeform a bit. I mean, you don't have to ask, you know, very specific questions about the book. And, you know, last year I was lucky enough to interview Harry Parker, who wrote Anatomy of a Soldier, which is a story of a soldier going through, I think, Afghanistan, loses his legs, which Harry indeed has lost his legs. He was absolutely brilliant, I thought, fascinating, and the conversation went way beyond the book itself to a whole range of stuff. So the books are the starting point. As I say, authors, I think, are generally used to, you know, it's part of the job now.
It's also kind of flattering to be asked. If you're at the level where people want to, you know, grab a drink and come and sit and listen to you, that's good stuff.
Yeah, and also, I mean, what we hope about Curious is that it's the scale allows people to feel very much at home. Our authors come for the weekend. We look after them. They feel comfortable. They'll go out into the park. They talk to a lot of people. They're very approachable. So it feels comfortable, I think. And we want people, and we want all our guests, you know, whether it's our authors, musicians, comedians, and our punters, to really, really have a lovely time and come away and thinking, you know, no stone has been left unturned to make sure they have a nice time.
I wanted to ask, you probably know this book, Mason Curry's book about, it's called Daily Rituals, and it's the thing that apparently constantly gets asked at literary festivals and festivals whenever there's someone up on stage. They don't want a grand idea of how a narrative was formed. They want to know what pen you use and what time you get up in the morning and what happens if you need a wee, should you break off halfway through the sentence and stuff like this. In your experience as an agent and as the putter on of a festival, there is a better word for that, and I'll think of it by the end of the show, when there's no Claire to impress.
I prefer putter on of a festival. Yes, I prefer that.
Is that what people always want to know? People want to go, well, what kind of pencil sharpener did you use, Martin Amis, that kind of thing?
I think questions are often very varied and often very unusual. I mean, yes, like where, you know, there are the obvious ones. Where do you get your idea? what is your writing practice? I actually find writing practice interesting. I'm interested to know whether somebody, I mean, writes in longhand or can do it on a computer or uses a fountain pen, and all sorts of different answers. But I think my favourite story was about a little boy who went to hear Maurice Sendak speak.
Okay.
And it was just after the publication of a classic children's book, Where the Wild Things Are, and everybody was sort of, you know, librarians and reviewers and critics, and were claiming it a masterpiece and all this sort of thing, and asking him, Maurice, very, very complicated questions. And this little boy just put his hand up and he went, "You, yes, what? And he went, "Who are the wild things, Mr. Sendak?" And he's just, and Maurice Sendak said, "They're my aunts." which is the brilliant insight that nobody else had got to.
So exactly.
I think that's one of my
favourite. Go for the jugular, person. Right?
Yeah, or just sometimes, you know. I thought that was a very clever question.
Can I throw in one other quick Maurice Sendak story? Because it made me think of it quickly. There was a mum who wrote back to Maurice Sendak. Her little boy had written to him saying how much he loved his books. And Maurice Sendak had drawn a picture in response and sent it to the kid.
Brilliant.
But then the mum had to write back to him and say, "Dear Mr. Sendak, thank you so much. Unfortunately, Johnny loved the picture so much that he ate it.
Oh, yes,
so
I
can
think
you send
I
another
heard
one?"
That.
And he loyally wrote
well,
out another
so
one again.
Sweet.
Sort of
yes, but I can understand that, can't you? It's exciting.
Yeah. And as we said, the festival calendar is very crowded, Claire. Yeah. Everyone needs a USP, whether it's a manuscript or whether it's a festival. This one seems to just be kind of. This one seems to be gin and good vibes, right? I mean, or am I selling your masterpiece short?
The point about the festival is you can have all sorts of adventures in it.
Yeah.
So if you want to just sit and watch the sun set over the yard arm with the gin and tonic and look out over the Solent, you can. If you want to, you know, put your life savings on the snail racing, you can. If you want to learn a Jane Austen parlour game, you can. If you want to go and hear Christa Hampton speak, you can. If you want to see some of the best comedians, you know, there are all sorts of journeys.
I think it's the snail racing, right? Because you've mentioned this couple of times, and
it's a very big feature of the festival.
Yes, it is. What is the best way to get your snail to win? Is this, I mean, because you sort of said feeding.
If you have to feed them really delicious stuff, sort of watermelon, avocado, they're trained up, they're fed, it takes a year to get them in sort of
race shape.
And then the big day is usually Sunday when there are three who race, and it's very hotly contested, I can tell you.
Amazing.
But
I was just thinking, you know, some watercress laced with ketamine would do it. That's just the authors.
That sounds more like a sort of Glastonbury vibe to me.
Okay. But sorry, Claire, I do apologise for that. That was not even in the script.
Claire, remind our listeners, where can they find out more? Obviously, the festival's later this month, 21st to 23rd. Where can they find out all the details that they might need?
Yes, everything's online. Sort of Curious Festival 2017. It tells you about how you can camp, you know, buy your tickets, what you can camp. It gives you the full programme. You can also sign up for all sorts of different experiences. As I say, you can sign up to learn how to play Jane Austen parlour game. You can learn how to keep bees. You can learn how to breathe. You can do life drawing classes. You can You can go and see the emergency poet, who will give you a prescription. If you're feeling, you know, depending on how you're feeling, she'll
definitely,
tell you what
definitely
books to read.
Definitely.
And she's got this beautiful ambulance arrives, and you go in and sort of lie down, and she's there, sort of looking in a very caring way at you, and say, "Tell me your problems." Blah, 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 blah. So there's lots going on.
A poetical bedside manner.
And lots for children as well. I mean, that's a really important part of what we do. And we love dogs on leads too. So
truly, the whole family, including the four-legged
relatives. And grannies,
relatives.
Because they like a bit of history and they a bit of Rachel Joyce. And so it really is a family festival. But then the mood changes from 5 to 7 o'clock. You've got comedy, so that kind of everybody gathers around and sort of relaxes and has a drink, and then the music kicks off, and then we have music till 2 o'clock.
We've kind of bullied you into talking only about Curious. Mm-hmm. You have to come back, and I know you've come in before and talked about the agenting, not just the putter honouring. But thank you for talking.
Agenting or honouring.
Yeah, exactly. But thank you very much, Claire, for talking us to the Curious Arts Festival and other stuff besides. Let's tell you again, it's from the 21st to 23rd of July, curiousartsfestival.com. Okay, we'll make short shrift of this because that was a great show. We don't need to do any bits and bobs at the end, do we?
No, wrapping up. We've talked about everything from snail racing to satire.
Exactly.
We went inside Donald Trump. That was unsavoury.
Exactly.
But fascinating.
I heard the click of the latex and I was in like Flynn. Okay, all it remains is us to thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, researched by Audrey Fyodorenko, and our studio managers were Kieran Banerjee and Toby Hammond. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.